So, let us continue. So, any questions about the previous sutta? Any complaints about the previous one? Do you really believe the Buddha knew about these things or have? You believe? Okay, that's good. Yes. Yeah. Are we experiencing that now? Possibly that's part of it. Maybe that's part of what he saw, but I think probably it's more like the expansion of the sun. You know, I think that's the main thing. But what we're experiencing now, global warming, has more to do with emission of carbon dioxide and that sort of thing. The sun may be warmer as well, but that's only part of it. I think what we experience now is more than that, right? It's also pollution and all kind of stuff as well. I think what the Buddha saw was probably the big picture. But maybe he saw this as well. I don't know. Possible. Yeah? Just uncertain sometimes. Okay. So let us continue. And now I would like to go back a little bit. So go back to the gradual training. Take you all the way back to page 14, is that right? Yeah, actually page 15. Yeah, because we're already done part. So back to page 15 again. So the idea here, what I'm doing here, as I'm going back and forth, because I'm using examples from other suttas to illuminate what is going on in the gradual training, right? That's why I'm going back and forth like this. I promise it's not because I want to confuse you or anything like that. There is a reason why I'm doing this. So we have now been looking at some length of the idea of sense restraint, how to overcome or also how to keep the defilements in check. That is what this previous passage was all about. And we have been looking at how wisdom power is really the key to overcoming the main defilements of the mind, the desire and the ill will and these kind of things. And now I want to have a look at the next paragraph here, which is very closely related to that. This is a paragraph on full awareness, or sometimes also called clear comprehension in the suttas. And for those of you who were here at the beginning, you remember we're talking about the sequence of things, how sense restraint is caused by clear comprehension. And here it's the other way around. Here it actually is, first comes sense restraint, then comes clear comprehension. In one of the early suttas, it was the other way around. Clear comprehension comes first, then comes sense restraint. So what's going on here? How come how come it's turned around? How come one place is before, another place is after? And this is kind of slightly strange, perhaps. And of course, the reason for that, I would say, is because these things are very closely related to each other. They almost like work together in a sense. When you have more clear comprehension, you have better sense restraint. And when you have better sense restraint, you have more clear comprehension. There are two aspects of the path that are very much a part of each other. And that's why there are sometimes, it doesn't really matter so much what sequence you have, whether you have one before the other one or the other way around, is not so important. And that's why you have it in this way. But in the gradual training, sense restraint comes first. And the reason for that, probably because you need a degree of restraint to be able to have full awareness in the first place. Otherwise, full awareness becomes impossible. But this is another way of looking at this. We're still dealing, in a sense, here with the right effort. So this is another way of looking at how to work with the mind in the right way. And it's interesting to have a look at this passage on full awareness. Now we are talking about sampajanya, right? Famous Pali word sampajanya, which you may have heard of. This is what we are dealing with here. Okay, so sampajanya is all about right purpose. I don't know if you remember that. I was talking about right purpose and suitability earlier at the beginning of the retreat. That's what sampajanya is about, suitability and purpose. So when I drink the coffee, I think, is it suitable? Okay, suitable, so I drink the coffee. And it gives a little bit more energy when you're going to have to talk so much. So that is how it works. So this is how this little paragraph reads in the sutta. He becomes one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, should actually be sleeping, being awake, talking and keeping silent. So this is this passage on full awareness. Often it is full awareness and sati, mindfulness, are often put together, called sati sampajanya, into one compound. But here we are dealing with full awareness as a separate issue, not as a compound. And very often it is separated in this way, and sati is a reference to the four satipatthanas, and full awareness has like a separate function like this, coming before the satipatthanas in the gradual training here. So what is this all about? And here we are, this is now very much dealing with the monastic practice, and I will show you in a second how it also relates to lay life, because it's not really just a monastic practice, it relates to lay life as well. But what you're seeing here is all those things that you do as a monastic when you are not in meditating, right? Not sitting down and meditating. So all of these things like going to the village to collect alms food, right? Talking, that's what I'm doing now. So that's, I'm supposed to have full awareness while I'm doing the talking and sit down there as well. So all of these things that you do when you're not sitting down in meditation practice, all these things that you know, basically that is part of monastic life, that is what really this is about. So you have to have clear awareness, full awareness, about all of these things that you're doing. Going forward and returning usually refers to going into the village, returning for alms. Looking away, looking ahead, this means that you kind of just know where you're going, right? So, or you go that you come to a house, you look to see if they're going to offer you some food or not. You have to kind of look out for these things. Flexing and extending your limbs is a bit like maybe putting out your alms bowl to receive the food and that sort of stuff. And carrying your bowls, it's fairly obvious that these things concern all of that. A lot of it has to do with arms around. Carrying your robe, outer bowl and robe, similar kind of thing. And then all the other things that you do, eating and talking and all this other stuff, going to the toilet, and all these things that you have to do apart from your meditation practice. All of that is included here. So the point, one of the things I should say, first of all, which is an interesting, important point here, and that is, it says here, falling asleep and waking up, right? So the translation, the Pali word is actually sutte, and sutte actually means sleeping. It doesn't mean falling asleep. There are other words in Pali for falling asleep. It actually means while sleeping. And jagariya, which is, I think, the Pali word for waking up, doesn't mean waking up. It means while you are awake. So the question then is, how can you be fully aware while you are sleeping? Because that's what this seems to be saying, right? Is that possible? And the answer is, not really. You can't be fully aware while you're sleeping, because when you're asleep, that is precisely not being fully aware. It's like going into, you know, you are in a different realm, so to speak, at that point, sometimes dreaming, sometimes not dreaming, whatever it is. So here the translation actually needs to be changed. And what is going on here is that this does not really refer to when sleeping. What it refers to, full awareness in respect to sleeping, in respect to walking, in respect to standing, in regard to sitting, in regard to sleeping, in regard to being awake, in regard to talking, in regard to keeping silent. In other words, it is not that you have full awareness when you are doing these things, it's that you have full awareness about these things. So you know how much you're supposed to sleep, right? You know the right amount of talking. You know the right amount of keeping silent. You know the right amount of being awake. This is what it really means. If you look at the Pali, it can be translated both ways. But here, I think the obvious way is the idea of about. If you know, you have to know a bit of Pali grammar to be able to actually translate these things. Otherwise, you are at a loss. You don't know what to do. And So some of you, I know some of you know a bit of Pali grammar. This is the locative case that you find here. So it is a locative of reference, referring about this, regarding this. And this whole paragraph, I think, actually reads much better if you read it as a locative case. It's about full awareness about going ahead and looking away. It's not that you have full awareness at all times, but you know what you are doing. You know the right amount. You know the right way of doing these things. And then you can see the translation comes out quite nicely. Then it starts to make sense how you can have full awareness about sleeping and all these kind of things. Then the question arises, what does it mean to have full awareness? This is the kind of the other important point here. And to understand that, I think it's very useful to go to the commentaries, because the commentaries talk about this in quite a bit of detail, and I think in quite a nice way, in a sense. And what they talk about four kinds or four aspects to the full awareness. Full awareness of purpose, of suitability, of resort, and of non-delusion. And of these, the two first ones are really the important ones. The first two ones are the ones that really matter, suitability and purpose. In other words, you know in your life what is suitable. What is suitable in terms of your spiritual progress? What will lead you in the right direction? What will lead you forward? What will not hinder you, right? This is the idea of suitability here, of purpose. And suitability is very closely related to that. Is the way you are doing this, is it suitable for that progress? Is it going to lead to less defilements or more defilements? Is it going to lead to more purity or less purity? And this is the idea here. So you have a sense with all the things that you do in your life, and here we're talking about all the things outside of meditation, you have a sense of, is it leading in the right direction? So if you are a monk and you go into the city and you look at all the beautiful things, oh, this is so beautiful, and you see a beautiful girl, wow, that was a really pretty girl, right? And oh, that's going in the wrong direction. And you know that that is when you are lacking in full awareness. You're lacking in clear comprehension, right? You're heading in the wrong way. You're not doing what is purposeful and suitable for the monastic path. That is what it means. Or when you're eating your alms food, you're kind of eating and completely oblivious. Wow, really kind of intoxicated by the food. Really, really nice food today. Whoa, I can't. Where can I get some more of this tomorrow, right? That kind of stuff. And then again, you're heading down the wrong track and you're allowing yourself to be sidetracked from the real path of Buddhism. But that is what it means by suitability and purpose, right? Full awareness. So you, first of all, to be able to do this is that you need enough mindfulness to know what is going on. And then you need the instructions somewhere at the back of your mind to remember what it is that actually works on this path. And then you're heading in the right direction. Right now it's kind of making sense, right? Otherwise you read this, you wonder what's going on here. It's not really clear. But now hopefully you have some idea of what is happening here. But this is not just something that is relevant for monastics. It is really relevant for everybody. You can use these things in your life. Ask yourself, is what I'm doing, is it heading down the direction of anger? Is it heading toward unreasonable and silly desires? Or is it something that actually is helping me on the Noble Eightfold Path? Is it something that makes me more peaceful, more content, more happy, more pure-hearted? Or is it something that drives me towards all these negative things and makes me more kind of selfish and stupid and deluded and all of these kind of things instead? So this is something that anyone can really use in their practice. And of course, it is not just in our ordinary life, but sampajanya is something that you can also, matters also in our meditation practice. And you will see in a second, once we start moving into the Satipatthana Sutta, we're going to have a look at the Satipatthana Sutta here, just to get a feeling for what that is all about. And one of the things it says in the Satipatthana Sutta at the very beginning is that you have sampajanya while you are practicing the Satipatthanas. Right? So you have a sense of purpose, a sense of suitability as you are doing your meditation practice. You're watching the breath, right? And then you know whether you are watching the breath or you're kind of fantasizing about something. You have clarity about that. That sampajanya also has to go into the meditation practice itself. So it is an all-round thing in meditation and outside. Always this feeling for whether you are heading in the right direction. Mindfulness, awareness to see what you're doing, and the wisdom, the instructions to know whether you're doing something which is appropriate or not. So that is the sampajanya factor on the gradual training. And I hope now that is making at least a little bit of sense to you. And it is usually separate from mindfulness in the suttas, because very often we confuse this with mindfulness, we bring it together with mindfulness, but actually they are two slightly separate things. One of the reasons why it gets confused with mindfulness is because this passage on sampajanya is actually also included in the Satipatthana Sutta itself. And that's why people think that this is all Satipatthana stuff. But really, the interesting thing here is whether that passage actually should be included in Satipatthana Sutta. And I will talk about that later on, because I think there are good grounds for believing that it shouldn't actually be there, and that is some kind of later addition. And that means that our view of Satipatthana actually changes quite a bit, because this kind of passage in the Satipatthana Sutta informs a lot about how Satipatthana tends to be practiced and talked about. I did say also that there are four aspects to sampajanya according to the commentary. I said the word resort, which is gochara in Pali. Gochara literally means where the cows go. So the cow's resort is the field where they graze, right? That's where the cows go. So what is the resort of a monastic? Where do monastics go? Where do lay people go who are Buddhists? Gochara, according to the commentary, is this idea of always being with your meditation object. But I wouldn't recommend that. I have never really seen anyone who has been very successful in the meditation doing this kind of practice. I don't think it is appropriate. I don't know where the commentaries get these things from. There's nothing really in the early Buddhist texts that say that we should always be with a meditation object. In fact, I've heard some people trying this, and it led to disasters when they tried to be with a meditation object all the time. There's one monk I know very well, who's also a very good scholar and also a very good meditator, and he tried this once, to be with the breath at all times. So I'm not sure if I told this here before, but he was walking Pindabat one day. This was in Sri Lanka, and he was watching his breath as he was walking Pindabat, right? And suddenly he didn't know where he was anymore, because he had walked down the wrong street, and now he was way out to the wrong side of the city, and he had a hard time finding his way back again because he had no idea where he was walking. And this is the problem, right? Because watching your breath, it takes so much attention on one thing that is impossible to at the same time also watch where you're going. So you can only really watch one thing at a time. So that's why I think that this idea, it is not really workable. And I'm not sure why the commentary is suggesting such things. And the last factor of full awareness, according to the commentary, is this idea of non-delusion, the idea that you should remember that this has got nothing to do, there's no self involved in these things. There's just the walking, just the returning, but actually there's no self there. But that is a very advanced part of this practice, and I don't think that that is really the main purpose of this. The main purpose is to overcome the defilements, to move towards meditation, to move towards samadhi, and then later on you start to get these real insights into non-self. So that's why I'm saying the first two aspects, purpose and suitability, that is really what this is about, to understand where you are going with a clear comprehension. So, now we have come to the end of the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right, we've been spending a few days just looking at that one factor, because I think it is an extremely important factor for anyone who is serious about Buddhist meditation and Buddhist practice, because it deals with the mind, and the mind is where the problems really are, right? If you can sort out the mind, then everything else tends to fall into place as a consequence. So dealing with the mind, wow, so important. And this is what we have been looking at now. And once that mind purity reaches a certain level, once your mindfulness is kind of starts to be established, that is when meditation meditation becomes possible. So now we're going to go into the meditation side of things, right? So that is great, good, isn't it? Is that happy with that? Yeah, it's great. So look at the meditation as well. So where do we go once the mind reaches a certain purity? That's what we're going to look at. It's going to take us a while to do that. So we'll see what comes out of this. So this is what it says here. The next aspect on the gradual training, possessing this aggregate or this sum total of noble virtue, all these aspects of noble virtue, possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness. It should really just be full awareness, because the text has had nothing about mindfulness yet. But really possessing full awareness, which of course includes a degree of mindfulness. So right, so he's now summarizing all of these things that we have been doing, and it's nice the way it says noble in front, right? It means that if you are doing these things, you are being noble, right? If you are practicing kindness, practicing this restraint, trying to live in the right way, you are being noble. So you have a sense, a degree, you know, a reason for being happy about yourself, that you are living a noble life if you're doing all of these kind of things. These little words like that, these are, if we read them in the right way, they are very encouraging, and you kind of feel that you are on the right track when you read these things in the right way. Sometimes when we always look for our faults, always look for what we can improve, it kind of gets, oh no, there's so many things to do. But when you remind yourself that actually you're doing really well already, and you're practicing in the right way, what a wonderful thing that is. So you possess all of these things. In other words, your virtue, your sila, is becoming very deep at this point, because you are, your mind is becoming pure, and all of these kind of things. Mindfulness has arisen. At that point, only at that point, do you resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, jhana grove. No, jhana grove is actually missing there. A mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, and a heap of straw. Right? All of these things are secluded places, far away from people, away in the wilderness somewhere, together with the animals and that kind of thing. So that is really the purpose of all of these things, to show that they are secluded places. A charnel ground is mentioned there because people don't like to hang out on charnel grounds. Usually you are left alone if you stay on a charnel ground. A charnel ground is a place where you burn the corpses, right? That's what it is. So this tells you a few things about what is going on here. First of all, when you see this, you know that we are now moving into the realm of meditation, because the only real reason you want to be in a secluded place is because you want to meditate, right? So at this point, we're moving towards meditation practice. So you can see here again this movement from sammapadana, right effort, moving to sammasati. Sammasati being now the beginning of meditation, and sammapadana still being the dealing with the mind in the right way. This is where the cusp, in a sense, is. We are moving from one to the other one. And you can see that from all these little clues here. The clues here is this idea of moving to a secluded resting place. That is a clue that tells us that we are moving in this direction. So when you do that, when you move to a secluded resting place, what happens? And what happens is the following. On returning from your arms round, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. So this is what you do, right, when you do this. And again, you can see that all of this has to do with meditation practice. This is a standard formula that you see also at the beginning of the Anapanasati Sutta, exactly the same wording. So these are kind of clue words that remind you this is real. Now we're talking about real meditation practice. So after your arms round, right, so this is, you know, you go and get your food in the morning, and then you do all of these things. You fold your legs crosswise. So does that mean that if you don't fold your legs crosswise, you are a bad meditator? Is that what it means? And I don't think that means that. Some people say it means that, but I don't think it means that. I think it just means that in those days, if you lived in the forest, you didn't have a chair probably, so you didn't have much choice. You had to sit down on the ground. So you would sit down on the ground. But you will notice very often they would sit at the root of a tree. And of course, the root of a tree, often it goes a little bit up as you get close to the tree. So you get a little bit of support there anyway when you do that. So it's like you're sitting a little bit raised usually, so you try to sit as comfortably as you possibly can. So I think that the point of this is just that was the way people sat at the time of the Buddha. That's how they were comfortable. That's what life was like. But it is not an absolute requirement. And I know many people who get good meditation from all kinds of postures, sitting on chairs, lying down, and all kinds of things. I remember hearing one time about a monk, he was standing on his head, and he was getting meditation as he was standing on his head. So I wouldn't recommend that, because if you get into the nimitta or something while you're standing on the head, that's what happened to him, then you can risk falling over and hurting yourself really badly. So please don't try that one. It wasn't meant as a suggestion. It just meant that meditation, nimittas, this thing can happen any kind of position, right? That's my point. And don't meditate too much if you're kind of sitting in the bathtub. Also be careful about meditating, because you might end up drowning, right? That's a very unfortunate side effect of that one. So any posture, any reasonable posture is acceptable here. Setting your body erect. So this idea here is that if you have practiced all of the previous stages on the path here, it means that you already have reasonable mindfulness. And if you have reasonable mindfulness, it's quite natural that you want to have your body erect, right? Quite straight. But remember that all of these things are about the right thing at the right time. And if you are not feeling mindful, if you're not feeling that your mind is clear, then forcing your body to be erect at the wrong time can often just lead to stress and tension. So know the right time for doing these things. I often recommend people, when they start out in meditation practice, to lean against something, like you can lean against the back of your chair, or if you want to sit on the floor, lean against the wall, right, or whatever it is. I can see somebody lean against the door down there, which is great. So you lean back, right? And then you can relax a little bit more. Because remember, it is about the beginning of meditation. It's always about giving rise to mindfulness. Then, when mindfulness arises in the mind, then it's almost natural that the body will kind of straighten itself up. So you will feel when that happens naturally. If it doesn't feel natural, just chill, relax, and just wait for things to arrive instead of forcing yourself. Otherwise, you're going to be uncomfortable. And really, it is the last thing we want to do is to make meditation practice uncomfortable. There is enough suffering in life, right? And I always like to ask people, haven't you got enough suffering already? Is there anyone who hasn't got enough problems in life? I'm a monk. I've got enough problems. I don't want any more problems. I want to relax in my meditation practice. And even those people who are, gone a long way on the path, they too have enough problems already. They want to just enjoy the meditation practice. Everybody has enough problems. So let's enjoy meditation. And when you enjoy it, it becomes a very powerful tool for practicing the spiritual path as far as you possibly can. Otherwise, after a while, you give up. And I've heard so many stories of people giving up on meditation because, oh, it's so terrible. Meditation is the worst thing. Everything but meditation in life. I'd rather torture myself than meditate. It was a famous experiment that was done in the United States. And there were people who were sat in this room. They were put into a completely empty room, right? There was nothing in the room except for one thing. And that one thing that was in this room was this thing. You could give yourself an electric shock. It wasn't very strong. It was kind of weak electric shock. But that was the only thing that was possible to do in that room, was to give yourself an electric shock. So people were put in this room, right? And lo and behold, they were only there for 15 minutes. And what happens in those 15 minutes? People could not bear the silence. They could not bear being by themselves. And because of that, they would go over and give themselves electric shocks, right? Much better to have suffering than not to have anything at all. And so we have to be careful not to make meditation like that, I'd rather have electric shocks than sitting in meditation, because meditation is such a terrible thing and such a kind of... So this is actually a real problem in life. It's too much of this kind of enforcedness, too much kind of forcing yourself to be silent when you don't want to be silent, to be by yourself when you don't want to be by yourself, to forcing pain in the body, eventually you're going to give up. And eventually you'd rather go back to ordinary life and have the ordinary suffering rather than adding to that suffering through meditation practice. So please remember that. And then you will have a long, happy life practicing Buddhist meditation in the right way. I know that there are certain meditation techniques, certain meditation practices that are used by certain groups. And there's very few people who come back to those groups, even though they are very popular because so many people go through those kind of meditation centers. The reality is that a very small percentage actually go back because the strictness of the routine is so high that the vast majority of people are not ready for that kind of thing. And they end up kind of giving up on meditation practice altogether as a consequence. So remember this. Everything at the right time, the right place, right? So don't be afraid of relaxing and enjoying. And then when the time comes, the body will become straight by itself. And then you know you're on the right track. And then the last part of the instruction here, establishing mindfulness before you. In other words, before you meditate, before we go into the Anapanasati, we'll see we have exactly the same instruction later on in the Anapanasati Sutta, similar kind of instruction also in Satipatthana Sutta. Mindfulness has to be established first. Without mindfulness, without that clarity of mind, meditation becomes basically impossible. And all you are doing is forcing the mind onto the breath, using willpower. After a while, you get even more tired than you are already, right? And things kind of collapse. So you are going to the breath too quickly, going to the meditation object too quickly, not allowing yourself enough time just to relax and enjoy what is already here. Just enjoying the peace, enjoying the good company, enjoying being free from all the burdens of life for a short time. And just doing nothing, and by doing nothing, mindfulness tends to arise. So this is kind of the trick of meditation practice, this incredible patience, right? And just learning to enjoy the little thing, the little peace, the little quietness. And when you do that, things really start to work for you. So you establish mindfulness. Now this establishing of mindfulness is at least two factors in that. And one of the factors is the establishment of mindfulness for every particular meditation session that we do. And that is really about, as I'm saying, just relaxing, not using any willpower, allowing things to be, re-energizing the mind and allowing the mindfulness to come up. We can only do so much in any one single meditation session, but we have to kind of try to allow the mindfulness to arise each time we sit down. But sometimes we find that the mindfulness only becomes so sharp, it kind of stops at a certain point, right? And then we kind of drift into fantasizing and dreaming and all these kind of things, and we kind of stay there for often a long period of time without really anything happening here. So why is that the case? And the reason that is the case is because we have not done often enough in our ordinary life to give the mind the natural mindfulness that comes from living well. Yeah, so this is why we've been talking so enormously much about the idea of sila, about purifying the mind, about having a good heart, about living well in the world, about being generous, and all of these kind of things, because that is really the foundation for establishing mindfulness. So if you do find that you haven't got enough power in your meditation practice, not so much in your daily life, because in your daily life you cannot expect meditation to become very powerful, but when you go on retreat and you still find that there is limits to your meditation practice, that is when you have to look back to these basic factors of the Buddhist path, and then you will find those things that will then give rise to mindfulness later on. So this is the kind of trick here, right? Establish the basics, the foundation, the core things. Establish them as strongly as you possibly can. And when you do that, then the other things happen as a matter of course. So that is the two aspects of mindfulness and how to give rise to that. And then, once you have given rise and established the mindfulness, what happens next? what happens next is this. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Covetousness is not a good translation in this context. What it means is sensual desires. The reason why it is translated in this way is because, the translator has stuck to this very rigid idea, one Pali word, one English word. The Pali word here is abhijja, and it is used here in place of kama chanda. Usually, you find kama chanda when we talk about the first hindrance, and this is why this is used. So, really what it means, abandoning sensual desire is really what it means. Abandoning desire, if you like, especially sensual desire or sense desire, sensory desire is another way to look at that. Abandoning ill will and hatred. He abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. Sati sampajanya. Sati sampajanya is the opposite of sloth and torpor, you can see here. Sloth and torpor means like tiredness, right? Tiredness and lethargy, the kind of thing you feel after the meal and that kind of thing. That sort of stuff. Percipient of light, the idea you have light in your mind when you have slothfulness, like the mind is a bit dark, right? Dull and dark. And percipient of light, if the mind is bright, is the opposite of sloth and torpor, the bright mind, which is clear, and you can see what's going on. And that is when you have mindfulness and full awareness as well. Huh? So you purify your mind from those things. Abandoning restlessness and remorse. Restlessness is the kind of agitation, always moving on to something else. And remorse also makes you agitated. You feel bad about something that you have done, right? You are remorseful. The mind doesn't become peaceful because you're thinking about it, turning it around in your mind. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. That was a bad thing. And sometimes the remorse is not even that obvious. It is just a slight darkening and dampening of your happiness. So you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly at peace. You purify your mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about good qualities. You purify your mind from doubt. So that is the last one, doubt here. Often people ask about the meaning of doubt in Buddhism. What exactly is the doubt about? And here you can tell straight away what the doubt is about. What it is about what is wholesome in the world, what is unwholesome. That is what it concerns. So abandoning doubt means to have clarity about what mind states are good and what are bad. Very similar to the things that we were talking about before. We're talking about the bojangas, where you have the Dhamma Vichaya Sambojanga, which is the awakening factor of investigation of qualities, right? That is precisely what this is about. You investigate these things so you can go beyond doubt as to what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. Or you have in the Satipatthana practice, the very last one is the contemplation of the five hindrances, what they are, how they arise, how they are abandoned, how they stay abandoned in the future. Similar kind of thing again. From that contemplation, you start to understand what the problems are, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. And that is how you abandon this kind of doubt. This is not doubt about how to walk from here to the shop, right? Anything like that. That's kind of completely irrelevant, of course. But sometimes people think in these kind of terms. So that doubt is a very specific spiritual doubt that has to do with what are good states and what are bad states in the mind. So I want to talk a bit more about these five hindrances because they are very important on the path. But we're coming very close to the time now, to 11:30, so I think I better stop there. And I will continue talking about this paragraph after lunch. So we will see you again at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Actually, downstairs, right? Is that correct, Lai? Downstairs. Okay, so we'll see you again downstairs at 2 o'clock. Yeah.